Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Richard B. Friedman, who holds the Herbert Asherman Chair in Economics at Harvard University. He is currently serving as Faculty Director of the Labor and Work Life Program at the Harvard Law School. He is also Director of the Labor Studies Program at the National Bureau of Economics Research, and a Senior Research Fellow in Labor Markets at the London School of Economics Center for Economic Performance. And he's a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. He's on the Berkeley campus in the fall of 2007 to deliver the Jefferson Lecture. Professor Friedman, welcome to Berkeley.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
Newburgh, New York was where I was born. And then was raised in New Jersey and Queens, New York.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My parents were very encouraging of certain things that I liked to do, for instance, reading and so on. And then they always had a sense of supporting the normal people in life, because our family does not come from a wealthy background.
When did they put the bug in you to focus on labor, or did that come later?
No, that came later. Though I assume there's something osmosis. You showed that your parents were favorable, I said, to normal working people in disputes and things, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, you know, those damn workers, what do they think they're doing?
Mm-hmm. And so where did you in the public schools? Were you in the public schools, and any teachers there who influenced you and pointed you in the direction of academic life?
No, not particularly. I mean, the teachers were fine, but there wasn't any single person who struck me. It wasn't until I got to college that I did have one mentor.
Were you at college, and then who was that mentor?
It was Dartmouth College, and the mentor was a man named Martin Siegel, who had been a Polish Jew, except for his wife, he and his wife were the only two people who survived in their high school class from the Nazis. Mm. And he was a very heroic guy. He fought in the U.S. Army. Mm. And because he spoke German and so on, he went behind lines and did wonderful things. And then was very strange about him. He was living in Hanover, New Hampshire, as an economist and did labor economics. And he got offers from other universities. And he was sort of afraid to leave because he said, well, Hanover, New Hampshire, he knows there aren't any anti-Semites around. And because we would think no university campus is going to have near Nazis and so on. But I think having settled in the U.S. and getting a safe place where he felt comfortable, he was not going to go out of his comfort zone.
Were you a political activist at all as an undergraduate, or no, it was mainly studying?
Mainly studying, and I also did a major in economics and mathematics. Mm-hmm. So I just took lots and lots of math courses. Mm-hmm. Very in that sense, abstract person.
And then your graduate work?
That was at Harvard with John Dunlop, who was the leading labor person at that mm-hmm. time.
And what did you focus on in your dissertation work? I mean, did you start in the place that you've wound up, or what was the evolution like?
No, well, I worked on the career choices of college students because I felt I knew something about that from personal experience. And so I still am working on things with science, engineering, supply of people going into the fields. And that was my dissertation was about that. I felt at that time that if I did things with unions or other things of that nature, first of all, Dunlop was the real expert, and I didn't know very much. And second of all, I'd just been through universities. That's what I knew. Mm-hmm. So stick with what you know, at least at the start.
Mm-hmm. In your work, you focused on labor economics, issues relating to working people, but then the evolution of who's doing what kind of work where are themes that you follow. But before we get into your work, what do you think are the skills that are required to do what you do?
That's interesting, yeah. Well, one thing is you have to like numbers. because you got to look at a lot of numbers to see how workers or other people are doing, and that's basic for almost any economist at this point who's empirical. And I'm like looking at rays of numbers and looking for patterns in the numbers. So that's number one. Two, I think very important being listening to people and getting outside your office and talking with folks, be they business people or union people or regular working people, because you get insights into how to interpret the numbers from those people. And I think the third thing is probably, which I may be weaker than I would like to be at, is being able to abstract or generalize from the numbers and from dealing with people to build basically mathematical models that then become the corpus of a powerful theory. And so those are the three attributes, and I think I have a pretty good idea that I'm pretty good at two of them. The other one I'm okay at.
But also in looking at some of your papers, which are online at Harvard, they seem to be pretty well written. In other words, for somebody like me who's not an economist and a mathematical modeler or a mathematical person, that it seems very important to then at this point of abstracting and then stating clearly what you're saying.
Yeah.
Basically.
Well, when I was young. I wanted to be a writer, and I've paid a lot of attention to writing skills. And then B, I tend to think, even for the most mathematical issue, if I can't write it really cleanly with no math and explain it to, say, my mother, who doesn't have great math skills at this point, then I don't understand it myself. Sometimes when I teach a very mathematical course at Harvard to undergraduates. And if I can't just explain it to them, I tell them, I don't really understand it, and maybe one of you students will help me, because if you have to put lots of algebra up there, somehow or other you're not capturing the idea. So I'm happy you like the clarity of writing. When you see something that's not clearly written, you'll know I really don't know what I'm talking about.
One of the papers that you had online, which I found interesting, and it might be a way to relate to what you just said to an actual topic, was the feminization of the workforce.
Oh, yes.
And so first, tell us what you found in that paper, but then how does it relate back to this methodology that you just described?
Okay, well, the basic finding is that what's gone on in the U.S., and now it turns out a lot of the advanced world in the last 30 years, has been, A, more women in the workforce, more women getting higher degrees. So today in the U.S., the women get 30% more bachelor's degrees than men. And then as these women go along with getting their better degrees, you begin to say, well, how are they doing in the earnings? And then how are they doing compared to their mates, their spouses? So that's what I looked at there. And I found was that I think it was 25 to 30% of the women with college degrees make more than their spouses. And then the last part of the thing is, okay, in the economics, if somebody makes more money in the market than someone else, then the person who should do more of the housework should be the person with the lower market wage. That makes sense. And then I looked and found that that was not occurring to any great extent, so that the women were really doing a double duty.
Even though there's, and then importantly, there was a comparative component to this, because you were essentially saying that women were the secret behind our ability to be a job producing machine in comparison to, say, the Europeans.
Yeah, I think the fact that the U.S. has opened so many doors to women, and women have gone through those doors, you know, rapidly and successfully. So, but was I think. It's about half of the job growth has been women, and women in the U.S., in contrast to Europe, often mostly work full-time. And whereas in Europe, there's a lot of women work, but they work part-time. And, of course, that's a big difference in your career. If you're a full-time person, you rise up much better. And I continue to believe that the secret to American economic success lies in our tapping this female resources. Sound very economist-like, but if women are getting 30% more bachelor's degrees than men, They're getting about the same number of law degrees and MDs as men. And you don't have career paths that use that resource. You have invested as a country, in the education skills of these people, and then not to use them would be disastrous. And we've done, a very good job at opening doors so they can use their skills.
And what led you to focus on this? Just that it was in the air, so many women were working. Was it a question of trying to understand American productivity? What?
Well, actually, this is one of the things which began. I looked at some of my graduate students. Mm-hmm. I noticed, remember, I originally taught this course, which is a pretty mathematical course for undergraduates. Originally, if I got one or two women in the course, I was happy. I tried to keep them because they were a little bit, not frightened, but uneasy with all these math, computer science majors and people like that who would generally be men. And then you see the women fraction going up and up and up, and you realize they're coming forward. And then I have a sister who is a doctor, and for a long period of time, she was the main earner in her family. Mm-hmm. Her husband's an inventor, and some of the inventions and companies that he formed failed, including one that I put some of my money in. And then it turns out now he's been a great success. Mm-hmm. But you just could see the critical role of women. So I was very tuned up to this topic from actually observations. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the issues I said I think is very important in labor economics, probably all of economics, that you keep your eyes open to what's going on in the society.
In a cursory examination of some of your papers, which I found online, so I am in no position to judge your whole career, I was struck by a sense of your, on the one hand, as an economist, your emphasis on the market, but on the other, a kind of a normative commitment to sort of looking at the consequences of markets and looking for the alternative institutions that might give us an opportunity to have market correction. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, where did that come from?
Okay, yes, it's a fair assessment. But I don't like making this sharper distinction between markets and the institutions, because I think the markets, in fact, generate institutions. We should think of markets as having socially determined groups working in them. Corporation, which we think of, of course, the corporations. Well, corporations are a legal entity created by law. Mm-hmm. And it turns out it was a great invention that we created. And then you say, well, what about some other institutions like trade unions? Well, unions also are a legal entity. And so the markets shouldn't be thought of as this invisible hand always operating without operating through the institutions. So it's true, a lot of my colleagues stress blind market forces, and I prefer to think of, no, markets have naturally these institutions, and therefore they're part of markets as opposed to against them. Now, it turns out the key thing about a lot of institutions, particularly the unions and labor institutions, is they tend to help ordinary people catch up with the wealthier and more powerful things. So they have a very important role to play as part of the markets. I don't like thinking of them as completely opposite things.
And if we're to understand what's happening to us in a way, I guess we have to begin with globalization, actually, which you talked a lot about in your lecture, because it's what's having this impact across the board. For you, what is globalization and what's important about it?
Okay, well, I'm very favorable to globalization, and what's important about it is that it's taking a lot of poor people around the world and bringing them into modern society. So places where Indian peasants or Chinese peasants, now suddenly they can connect up to modern technology, modern education, and their living standards are going to rise tremendously. So to the extent that we think of globalization as the extension of all the things we have learned, and we've learned most of it in the West, the advanced countries, that's now being extended to these billions of people, and they will be able to contribute to things. I think it's in that sense, it's a great thing.
Mm-hmm. And so what? But what are the? Let's look at labor now. We're going through this period now where we're really being affected or realizing the rise of China and of India and so on. And in concrete terms, what does that mean for the working man and woman, both here and there?
Okay. Well, it's generally completely good for the working people there. Mm-hmm. And they have some problems. There's big inequality in India. The inequality has been rising in China. And so they're going to have to work through their problems. But in general, you're on a very rapidly rising trajectory. I mean, wages are rising in China 7% a year. That's pretty massive. But then, you know, GDP is rising 7-8% a year, 9% in China. India is also seeing increases. And they have to work through those things. For us, it's a little more difficult in some ways, because suddenly we face competition with workers who are paid much lower than we are. And so we can't just bumble along. We have to, I think, be, as a country, much more thoughtful about what we invest in, how we spend our money, what kind of schooling we get. We don't want to be a computer programmer competing with tens of thousands of Indian programmers who are just as good as we are, who may have learned from exactly the same textbooks as we learned from, because the spread of knowledge is there, and whom American companies will, or Indian companies for that matter, in the global world will hire because they're cheaper than we are. So we have to pick our places a little more carefully.
Mm-hmm. You in your lecture, you pointed out that in the old days you used to be able to look at these emerging powers and say, "Oh, good, they're making transistor radios, or you know, making something at the low end," and we used to be confident that they wouldn't rise to the higher level. And what you were suggesting is that's changing, and how is it changing?
Yeah, that's changing because of two things. One is the spread of higher education, and much of it being taught in English. In India, a lot of education being English, and even in China, this spread. So they tap into exactly the same knowledge base that we had. It used to be that was not the case, that they couldn't tap into this knowledge base. And B, it is the corporations who play a very interesting role. So IBM now declares itself a global corporation. Mm-hmm. Cisco, at one point, when Cisco was doing some investments in China, said we're a Chinese corporation. But Cisco, and I think like IBM, and probably true of most of the multinationals, they are global corporations. They're spread. They're not going to use less good technologies in China or India than they use in the U.S. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so they are doing a wonderful thing of spreading the technology. But one of the things that kept American wages high, of course, was that we had access to the best technology much earlier than other countries. So maybe it would have been, I don't know, 30 years before the technology would spread to a low-wage country. So now it may spread 5 years, maybe even quicker. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing is the India and China produce more and more highly educated people, some have educated in our country, some educated in their own. The big corporations are even doing their R&D activities in those countries. And so that creates a tension.
Mm-hmm. And you're suggesting, I think, that if you double the size of the labor market as you globalize, that it's very inviting for capital to move to where that cheap labor is.
Oh, yes, and that's clearly what all the multinationals are doing. And again, it's great for those poor countries. They now have the modern capital and modern technology. But it's not so great for us. I mean, as consumers, we clearly benefit because they're now producing goods at much lower prices, and so we can buy many, many more things. So we clearly benefit that way. And then the question is, what happens to us as workers? And there it is less clear, you know, whether it's good or bad, because it depends. If there are a lot of them in exactly the same field as we are, then we're going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. But if we've got some differentiated product, the way the economists would talk about it, so the American degree or the American training has certain unique features to it, you know, then we'll benefit more than it will cost us.
Mm-hmm. Now you, and this gets very complicated, I guess, when we factor in immigration, when we factor in the key role of educational institutions, and I know in some of your work that I read, we can make choices that have negative consequences, although politically they're what popular. Here we think of immigration, build a wall at the border, and so on. So first let's talk about what your findings show about the consequences of immigrant labor in the United States for the working class here. Because immigration is part of globalization.
No, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Correct. Immigration is a critical part of globalization. And I would say one thing one could ask is, would you rather have someone come as an immigrant to our country, work in our country, spend in our country, or would you rather have that person do the exact same work in some foreign country? And I think in general, we would prefer having the person come as an immigrant to our country. They do their spending in our country, and they become, you know, part of us, if I can phrase it right. So that's sort of a trade-off. Do we want companies to offshore certain jobs, or we'd rather bring in immigrants to help do those jobs? I mean, in general, the evidence on do immigrants have a big adverse effect on Americans, I think, is very limited. They probably have some adverse effect on some Americans. Let me give an example. At one point, we got a big influx of Russian immigrant mathematicians. And some of my friends were getting PhDs in mathematics at that particular period, and they found that the universities preferred these Russian mathematicians whose theorems were they were teaching in the textbooks to the newest U.S. trained mathematicians. Well, our people were just starting off. And some of our young mathematicians, therefore, couldn't get jobs in universities. Turns out many of them went to Wall Street, and they made much more money. And the Russian immigrant folks could not conceivably have gone to Wall Street. They were great at proving theorems, but they weren't.
You just demonstrated the importance of studying labor markets.
Oh, that's good. That's good. But they were unhappy, that those are the young people. And that can occur in almost any field. Suddenly a big influx of foreign labor that competes with you. But everybody else benefited. So suddenly the American universities had these great mathematicians teaching the next generation of graduate students, illuminating things. And so what usually happens in immigration is we get immigrant flow. The people who compete directly with the immigrants suffer something, although they then move on to other occupations or other areas until the market equilibrates. But the rest of us benefit. I mean, let me give another example, which is very clear to all Americans, I think. Say we could get in tomorrow 100,000 really superbly trained and wonderful, and I'll say Indian doctors. They speak English perfectly, and they're just as good as our doctors. I assume if we had a referendum on that, the American people would say it means better medical care, lower costs because they're going to compete with our doctors. We would vote for that in a landslide. American doctors, the AMA, which is the union of the doctors, would probably say, oh, my God, no, we can't allow this. This is terrible, because their members would clearly lose something from this. And that's the issue in immigration. On net, though, I think immigration benefits the bulk of people in the country.
But what about the lower end of the job market? Is it worse for them, or does what you just said hold true also for those?
Well, it holds true also, but of course, one of the aspects of immigration has been that we've got a big influx of low-skilled immigrants, which in numerically is very, very large. And if it wasn't for this influx, we would be, maybe half of the people with less than high school degree, or a third to a half, whatever. the numbers are, would not be in the country. Mm-hmm. And so the very bottom of our education workforce consists of immigrants, mm-hmm. you know, many from Mexico and Latin America. And that clearly has an effect on the low-skill Americans, I think. You know, but again, if you differentiate yourself and you're doing something different and maybe you're living in a different area than where the immigrants pour in, that you're safe. And then eventually what happens, of course, the immigrants spend their money in the U.S. and they build up more skills. And so, yes, there's some loss. I think mm-hmm. one would not want to deny that. No estimate that I've seen says it's really big. And so it strikes me as a modest loss for what is a huge gain for the immigrants. I mean, one of the things one wants to do, in a sort of moral sense, is you say, okay, some poor person comes from Mexico, and they will, yeah, their earnings will go up, let's say, six times what they could get in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And then their children can go to school where they wouldn't go to school that much in Mexico, and all kinds of positive things, which is why they come. And maybe it does harm some low-wage American competitor by a few percent. We just have to weigh those two things, the gains to one, six-fold increase in their well-being, a loss to the other, a few percent loss of their well-being. Mm-hmm. And we have to value that.
In your immigration writing that I read, this is an example where you say, okay, if certain people are suffering, that we should figure out a way to compensate them in order that this inequity that's resulting might be rectified.
Yeah, well, I think the right way to we have some great policies to do that, and unfortunately the current administration has not been pushing them. Mm-hmm. The one great success of the Clinton administration was expansion of the earned income tax credit. And that was saying for people who work and are low paid, and you might be low paid because there are a lot of immigrants competing with in that job market, that could be one reason, we just cut a check to you. Mm-hmm. And we say you're an American citizen and you shouldn't get an income below this level, so we have our earned income tax credit. That was originally a Republican idea. And it's unfortunate the Republicans have no longer seem to believe in it. And the Clinton administration, a great successful thing, they expanded that income tax credit. And that's been followed. Many countries around the world have copied this. The British have a family tax credit that is similar. It's extremely successful because it encourages people to work, encourages them to take even low-wage job because they will be getting more money from the state, and that's one way we can take care of people.
In the case of higher education and education, I read a piece that you wrote on reforming the support of graduate students in the sciences, and ultimately you seem to be suggesting that this is linked to globalization also, as you're getting a surplus of graduate students from foreign countries, which we talked about a minute ago as a result of globalization.
That's right.
And so on. Right. And so talk a little about that, because it recalls your first dissertation way, but you're again saying, well, we have to make institutional adjustments in order to respond to this impact of markets.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the job market for scientists and engineers is not in great shape, particularly for scientists and people at the PhD level. You have these long postdocs, you have long training periods, and it's not that attractive for young Americans. One of the other reasons it's not that attractive is, I think, purely for inadvertence. Government used to give out lots of fellowships to go to graduate school, and they haven't increased. The NSF has not increased its number of fellowships for 40 years, even though the population has grown and the number of people graduating with bachelor's degrees in science and engineering has gone up. So my proposal was, let's just go back to the incentives that we offered Americans before 1960s, mm-hmm. and simply increase the number of graduate fellowships that the NSF gives. That would be a very big increase. It would be about threefold. Now, you might say, well, gee, if this attracts a lot of Americans in, and we still have a lot of foreign folks coming into science engineering, it's going to really glut this this labor market, and that is possible. But at least you want to offer the Americans the same options, let's say, that you might have for someplace else. And I think that in the long run, and I hope the long run is relatively short, the country will go on a big research and development expenditure program, because if we're going to defeat global warming and we're going to have energy, deal with the energy problem and other things, we have to put more money into research and development. That's the heart of our economy, I think. Mm-hmm. And so then this would also be providing more young Americans in the area. And foreign guys can come too. We're happy. Mm-hmm. Maybe I think it's great that this country can be a mecca for knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that indeed, I think, would ideally be our contribution and our distinct feature, say, compared to the Chinese or the Indians, who are struggling, right? I mean, they're doing very successfully, struggling just to get up to modern technology. And when they get a little further advanced, it'd be great if we could say, oh, by the way, we've got these wonderful machines and things we've invented that'll help deal with your pollution problems, that'll help deal with the global warming problems. And for that, I think we need our best brains, American brains and foreign brains.
Mm-hmm. I get the sense that one of the problems we're confronting is not just the problems, which we've talked about, the consequences of globalization and making adjustments, but also the ideology of within our political system that sounds like they want to throw out the baby with the bath. As I listen to you, because what you're saying is that we need to fine-tune the markets with the help of government, whether you're talking about the earned income credit, whether you're talking about more university fellowships from the federal government, and so on. And so that sounds like that could be a long-term problem where a misunderstanding of what makes market capitalism work leads to conclusions that are problematic.
I think that's correct, and unfortunately, the current administration, elected as compassionate conservative, have turned out not to be very thoughtful on these dimensions, I think. And what's happened in the world, I mean, they were part, let's be clear, because in the 1990s, the communists disappeared. Mm-hmm. And I think we went through a period of market triumphalism. Our way clearly was better than what they were doing. And then we went around the world, a lot of economists were involved in this, and preaching markets, just trust markets and everything will work out. I think now there is a major rethinking of that. I mean, we can think about it in the IMF and the World Bank, which were selling this Washington consensus. Well, that the Washington consensus, to quote one World Bank president, is dead. Mm-hmm. Nobody thinks that you can do that. There's a little bit of that thought, unfortunately, still in our current administration. Hopefully, the next administration will have a much more thoughtful view of this and will understand, yeah, you need a market economy, clearly, but it does need some assistance from government. And in particular, in the areas of education, and research and development, the basic research will not be done by companies. They cannot, it's too risky. They cannot just do that kind of stuff. And that's the heart of innovation and technology and advancement. And it has to be done by the government. I suppose, think of someone who is substituting in part for what government perhaps should be doing. Bill Gates has got huge sums of money, some of it thanks to Warren Buffett, and he's doing major research and development and activities that you would like to see an enlightened government
mean in his foundation.
His foundation. Yeah. Yeah, no, not in his Microsoft, it's a different business. Yeah, his foundation. And that's an interesting sort of substitution. But of course, even with his sums of money, we still have a major need for government. And, of course, you don't want one billionaire, even with a good foundation, making what looks like wonderful decisions. It should be decisions made by the bulk of the American people through government, because he's focused on certain issues. And, you know, we might want to focus on some other issues, and there's place for both.
Mm-hmm. In your Jefferson lecture, you emphasized importantly, and you touched on it before, but I want to bring this out, that the consequence of globalization at home in many countries is to increase inequality as it's increasing equality globally. Talk a little about that, because that's if that's happening everywhere in the major industrialized countries, that's important.
No, and it is happening pretty much every place. To attribute this rise of inequality to globalization per se is probably a bit of a stretch. Mm-hmm. I think globalization has contributed to it, but so too has technical change and weakening of unions and other things. But you go country by country and you see inequality going up, including the developing countries as well. China's had one of the greatest increases of inequality in the world. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if we calculate an inequality measure of everybody in the world, so the world sort of inequality measure, it's gone down. It's gone down because China and India, which have a third of the human race involved in there, have been increasing their incomes a lot. So the very poorest people in the world have really zoomed ahead. And hopefully, Africa will be next in zooming ahead, and Bangladesh and some other countries Indonesia will zoom up to. So, but within those countries, as within the U.S., the people who do the best are the most highly educated, the people with the most skills, it's the business owners, so on, and the poorer, less educated folks are doing not so well. And that is potentially dangerous, because the fact that my country is growing, but I am not growing, could lead to social instabilities. It could lead to all kinds of problems. The Chinese are deeply concerned about this, as they should be. I think the Americans were very, for a certain period of time, we were very blasé about this, and the current administration is probably the last of the folks who don't seem to appreciate it. President Bush did make an interesting statement about a year and a half ago at the New York Stock Exchange. He said, inequality is real. Mm-hmm. And I said, but he never followed up. And I assume some of his economics advisors were telling him, you cannot deny this is like global warming. Mm-hmm. You've got to recognize this. But then the issue is, will they develop policies to respond to this? And there we've seen the ideology in Washington certainly has not moved in the policy area.
And in terms of concrete policies, the tax cuts increase the amount of this increased wealth to the wealthy, basically. There's a real redistribution problem.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you think of what you want to do if you're a government is lean against the wind somehow, particularly if the poor are suffering. And what the current government has done is they've leaned with the wind. Mm-hmm. And so the rich were doing very well without any big tax cuts. They gave them big tax cuts, so now they're doing even better, even more well. And that's a very strange strategy in some sense. And it's one of these things where you say, was the administration elected? Did they campaign? One thought, compassionate conservative. I was not unhappy that Mr. Bush got elected. I thought, well, it's he's going to be a compassionate conservative. That's not terrible. Mm-hmm. That could be good for the country. But I didn't realize the compassion, was only for people making over $1 million or something like that. That it was a very limited compassion.
That's right. You pointed out that in your lecture that one of the consequences of globalization, which we hear about all the time, is that the capacity of governments to control their domain through regulation and so forth. So it's not just lowering taxes on the wealthy, but it's also governments' incapacities in the face of become very important. So this is another element in this inability to sort of move against the wind.
No, that's right. Some governments, to some extent, have lost a certain amount of control. There's nothing the U.S. government can do within any reasonable thing that's going to affect the giant multinational corporations' decisions to invest overseas. Mm-hmm. We can do some tax changes. There's some things that we can operate on the margin. But, you know, in the end, you're going to sit there as a corporate executive and you're going to say, very good American, costs me $80,000 a year. Very good Indian, costs me $8,000 a year. Who am I going to hire? I mean, and if I don't hire the Indian, an Indian company will hire the Indian, and they'll beat me out in the global economy. So there's some things that we can't deal with. That means we need a more competent and better operating government, not a less competent government that says, throws its hands up. It's got to look for different ways to strengthen the U.S. The corporations are not acting in the U.S. interest. They're acting in the interest of their shareholders, who, some of whom are Americans, some of whom are very wealthy Americans, but many of whom are also foreign people, and that's what companies are supposed to do in a capitalist system. The government's supposed to act for us. And a government that decides just to throw up its hands up and simply go with the wind is not doing its duty.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about in your lecture the alternative places that we can go to find some of these solutions, and you discussed the extent to which that at the state level, that is hearkening back to states' rights, that you're getting a lot of innovations that give us the adjustment that we want. But the great irony, of course, is that we can no longer look to the national executive to do this in the way we did during and after the Depression.
Yeah, no, it is a striking fact that most legislation at the state level, most of the more helpful to workers legislation, comes at the state level than comes at the federal level. States seem to be capable of reaching agreements between the different participants in the state politics. We've seen Republican governors, Republican legislatures, Democratic governors, Democratic legislatures coming together to resolve state problems. Whereas when it gets to the national level, we've seen ideology rule. And I'm not sure why this is, but it does seem to be a good empirical observation. And you can take as example the governor of California. Now, he's gone through a right-wing phase, and he's gone through a more moderate phase. But he does seem to be trying to resolve real problems. And the state legislature seems to be, you know, dealing with him in that same vein. And so there seems to be more pragmatism at the state level and less ideology. And I think where you could say, well, this is just the Bush administration that's being ideological. I think the Democrats get back in, there'll also be more ideology at that level than there'll be at a state level. So I'm very favorable to federalism, to states being able to strike out on their own and try to solve problems on the notion that, A, they'll do it very pragmatically, and, B, this is, no one can be sure what the real solution to some problems are. Let's see some different trial efforts at different places, and we can see what works better.
And I think it was Brandeis you quote as saying that federalism is a laboratory of experimentation. Really,
that's right, and that's the great virtue of our system is that different states can try different things within limits. Obviously, we need some national. We have a Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. We have some constitutional things that every state's got to go by, and we have some federal laws that everybody has got to abide by. But then the best example is the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. The Bush administration, as far as I can see, for strictly ideological reasons, all of it may even be because they get large contributions from some people, have not raised the minimum wage for an extended period of time. They've been opposed to that. Well, what's happened is that two-thirds of the American workers now are covered by a minimum wage above the federal level. It's state after state. It's states with Republicans, it's states with Democrats, because they can look out and see their own people, and they can see that, gee, if we give an extra 50 cents or a dollar to the minimum wage workers, it's not going to cause a great job loss. Instead, it's going to actually improve the living standards of some people. And that's true in a whole bunch of other legislations that that states have passed.
And the really dark side of this, from what you're saying, is that the executive at the national level under the current administration has sought to prevent states from doing some of the experimentation that we've talked about.
Yes. No, the conservatives in principle favor states' rights, and they're more libertarian. Let's let things go at the lower level. Local people should make decisions. And I personally think they're right about that. But having control of the White House, and when the Republicans had control of both the houses of Congress, they actually passed an incredible amount of legislation to limit what states could do. So if California wants to do something about the emissions from cars or whatever it is, no, they try as hard as they can to stop that. Some states want to do things for children to get better, more health care spending. No, they try to stop that. And it's a stunning sort of switch of a betrayal of conservative ideals that have a major place in our country and have a good place in our country, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about the problems at home and explored at least some of the possible responses. In some of your other work, you've looked at what we can do about what's going on internationally, and here you focused on, common standards for labor throughout the world and how we get those implemented in different places. Talk about why that is important and why, it complements the positive aspects of globalization.
Well, right now, consumers in our country and in Europe have some information about the quality of labor that went into the products, the labor standards that went into the products that they buy. There's a great example just this last week when the Gap was found out that some of their subcontracts were basically using slave child labor. And instantly they canceled the contracts and they're going to clean up this act. Nike had already been through a series of things where Nike went from being a company that didn't care and hid what the labor standards of its to being one of the best companies of providing information and saying they're trying hard to get the standards up and so on. This is because we, as consumers, want better standards. Globalization has done is it's put our spotlight, be it on factories in India, in Pakistan, in China, and if someone can say that an American or a European retailer is using products made under very poor conditions, that retailer nowadays will react quickly. Hopefully they won't cancel contracts. Instead, they will sort of force the subcontractor to improve or move the contract to another subcontractor who does have better standards. And I think it would take much longer for the standards to go up in those countries without this pressure that we have placed on them. But I understand the pressure is a good pressure because what it means is we're willing to pay more money. I'm willing to pay whatever it is, a dollar more for my sneaker if I know that that dollar is going to help make safer work conditions or a higher wage for the low-wage worker in Indonesia or China who is making that sneaker. And what's interesting is that shows up across the boards. That consumers really are willing to do that.
And on issues like child labor, discrimination, on issues also like labor's right to organize and so on. I mean, one can hope for some movement through both what consumers want, but also you're suggesting through international organizations.
Yes. Well, the International Labor Organization, which is a very weak organization, does have a set of labor conventions that countries can sign up to. And they're very sensible, their things. I mean, it's not to ban child labor. It's you try to get rid of the worst kinds of child labor. And as you develop, you move further away from using children, because children would be better if they're in school. But you obviously, they better have food in their stomachs. They need enough income, etc. Well, what we've seen during this period of globalization has been extraordinarily rapid signing of countries onto these conventions. Mm-hmm. Now, signing a convention does not mean that anything is enforced. But we are seeing inside every one of these, almost every country, probably Burma's being an extreme exception, and Burma's like one of the only countries in the world the ILO has denounced for basically not following normal labor policies, etc. Some of the countries, there are problems, but inside those countries, there are groups of workers and citizens, civic groups, that are trying to improve labor standards. Mm-hmm. And this strengthens them as mm-hmm. well, because they now have a whole international mm-hmm. commitment. Their countries signed the agreement. China is really stunning in that in 2007, they passed a new labor law designed to basically increase collective bargaining, increase the power of their communist-controlled unions. So they're not free unions, we understand that. But if the communist-controlled unions begin to stand up more for workers in China and do not oppose the party in politics, which will get them into trouble, though maybe they should oppose them 20 years down the road when they have sort of established themselves, that's an incredible sign. Here's the country growing the fastest and says that it needs stronger unions to help improve the situation in their country.
Well, one of the examples that you cite is using export zones to actually be a vehicle for this, because that's really intriguing. Because okay, you want to get richer by processing and making it easier to do exporting from your country, then also bring along these standards.
Yeah, I mean, because export processing zones are producing for the global market. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that they should be the ideal place where we guarantee good standards. Turns out, in general, that's not been the case. And these export processing zones have very mixed record. I think that's a foolish mistake by both the exporting countries and by the U.S. and other multinational firms that are involved in them. They've particularly been bad, and some of them on the rights of workers to unionize. So that's a tough thing. And I think they should be made the golden place where everyone looks at this is what globalization brings us. It brings us a export processing zone where standards are high, where health and safety conditions are good, where the workers can unionize, dot, 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 dot. Some countries have used good labor standards. The Cambodia is probably the big example, as a competitive edge in global markets. And there, the ILO and the U.S. government, under the Clinton and the Bush administrations, have been helpful to the Cambodians in terms of getting good standards. It turned out to be a competitive edge. So I would hope that could have been generalized.
Well, one final question, and that is students watching this program who sort of now know more about your career and what you've worked on. How would you advise them to prepare for the future if they wanted to do the kind of work you're doing, but also draw out its broader implications? Because you really are on the edge of human rights work in a way, as you, through economic modeling, right, explicate some of these issues.
Well, I think the students should, of course, start in the most basic abstract scientific work, and then I think you move on later in your careers to more, quote, practical stuff. But I think one of the striking findings in economics nowadays is that some of the human rights things are caring about fairness and so on. it's not some aberration not some lefty, bleeding hard liberal. It's actually hardwired into human brains that we care about fairness, that we care about conditions. That is not aberrant. That's why I come back to markets are based on humans and on institutions that humans create, and this is part of capitalism. This is a good part of capitalism, I think. So I would think the great place for students to study is indeed the evolutionary, biological, neuro things that indeed lead people to care about human rights as well as other things, and that become a normal part of economics, where it kind of was not banished, but you just sort of thought to be, that's a softy thing. Well, it's not soft if evolution has built it into our psyches that we get upset when we see people unfair. It is not ridiculous or strange that we are willing to pay more for products made under good conditions, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's a great area for students who are concerned with, you know, human rights things. The more we can biologically ground that, the harder it is for people on the other side of this kind of the issues to sort of justify their position. And I do believe knowledge ultimately, you know, triumphs in the end. So more knowledge about this would be very helpful in changing economics and making it more of a human field.
Professor Freeman, on that positive note and really advice and hope for the future, thank you very much for being here today.
Okay. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.